This is Guns and Butter.
I would not say this is a time of celebration. I would say this is a time to get us active, to be fighting for fundamental rights. I never thought I'd be saying we had to fight for the fundamental right of habeas corpus, or the right not to be wiretapped, or the right to be charged before you could be held in prison. I would never have thought I'd have to say that. But these are the rights we have as people, and we are determined to get them back.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michael Ratner. Today's show, the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a nonprofit human rights litigation organization in New York City. He has led the center in its aggressive legal fight against the post-9/11 violations of civil liberties by the Bush administration. He was part of the small group of lawyers that first took on representation of the Guantanamo detainees in January 2001, a case that went to the Supreme Court, where a major victory was won in June 2004. The Center for Constitutional Rights has also filed cases on behalf of Bagram detainees challenging the Military Commissions Act that purportedly abolishes the writ of habeas corpus. He and his colleagues continue to represent hundreds of Guantanamo detainees and coordinate some 500 attorneys across the country on their behalf. So let's take a look at the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which are referred to as the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for a redress of grievances. So that First Amendment covers a lot: free speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. How are we doing with that one?
Well, we're not doing so well is the sad truth of it. I mean, I think we've all seen, certainly since 9/11, the incredible restrictions on protest in this country. We've seen the government attempt to stop it. We've seen, you know, of course, revelations about the Pentagon and other government agencies going into peaceful protest groups, putting informants in them, doing surveillance on them, and essentially trying to destroy a protest movement in this country. Because as the policies of war, of torture gain, there's more and more an economic deprivation gain, there's more and more protest, and the government has really undercut that severely. So, for example, we had a case in New York that stemmed out of the 1970s and the massive amount of infiltration that took place into progressive movements. And the police were restricted from doing all kinds of things. After 9/11, the judges lifted all those orders. The police were allowed to do a whole bunch of surveillance again. So again, that's one of the key ones. But you can go to the other areas. Go to the area of free exercise of religion. Now, what that means is two things. One is you have the right to exercise your religion, but you also, that amendment prohibits the government from exercising a particular state religion. The people who wrote the Bill of Rights were in part fleeing for religious freedom initially, and they didn't want the state involved in religion. And of course, under Bush, we've seen much more involvement of the state in religion. And you've seen social programs that go to religious groups that are called, you know, this whole way of getting social work and so-called good works done through religion and through religious groups. You've had cases in the Supreme Court that have said you can use school facilities now for religion. And you had a case this year that was a real shocker. You know, normally, in the normal circumstances, a taxpayer, you or me, can't complain about the way government money is allocated. That has to happen through the election of our government officials or our Congress. There is one exception, or there was one exception. If the government was funding religious activities or arguably religious activities, taxpayers had the right under the First Amendment to challenge those activities. This year, Supreme Court, 5-4, say that taxpayers don't have that right to challenge government-funded religious activities, and that therefore, essentially, the government is going to be free to do that. So on both freedom of religion, on the right to protest, were in trouble in the First Amendment. There were a couple of other interesting First Amendment cases this year in the Supreme Court that indicate how far down the road we've gone into a bad place. I'm sure people remember this case. A high school student, when he was out of school, outside the school, held up a sign that said, "Bong hits for Jesus." What it meant, no one could really figure out. But the school disciplined him, even though he was outside the school holding the sign up. And it went to the Supreme Court. Again, 5-4 decision. The student had asserted he had a First Amendment right to say it. The Supreme Court, 5-4, said, no, he did not. And some of the justices even said there's no First Amendment rights at all involving students in high schools. So, again, a serious cutback on First Amendment rights. And then, you know, what they do is, what's fascinating about the First Amendment is they protect the First Amendment rights of corporations to do certain kinds of First Amendment activities that they might not give you or me. So, for example, a case that, again, was decided in the Supreme Court said that in political campaigns, corporations can give as much money as they want to issue-oriented advertising. And they can even mention the name of a candidate just so they don't tell us how to vote. So if the corporation likes smoking, for example, and it wants to put up a sign that says, you know, this candidate is in favor of gun control. We think gun control is a terrible idea. Corporations have now unlimited funds to be able to, or lobbyists, to fund that kind of campaign. So it's like the First Amendment with a vengeance, whereas if you give money to a political campaign of a particular candidate, you're very limited. So what it really does is increases the powers of those who already have money to get their issues heard. So what we have is this odd situation where First Amendment rights of us who are doing protests, of us who, like this high school student, are being limited, but the First Amendment rights of those who want to spend a lot of money to get their message across are actually being amplified.
In addition, the freedom of religion, it wasn't so safe to be a Muslim after 9/11. They were being rounded up, weren't they?
You know, I'm glad you brought that out. They did that, of course, less explicitly than the Supreme Court saying you can round up Muslims, although we did have one case that relates to that. But, you know, we at the center represented hundreds of Muslims who were rounded up after 9/11, and they were rounded up only, really, because they were Muslims from particular countries. Even though they had done nothing wrong, they were out of status on their green cards, but they decided we're going to arrest and hold Muslims as terrorists. And that's what they did. And in one of the cases the center brought called Turkmen, the judge actually held that you could, in a discriminatory way, immigration authority could actually, in a discriminatory way, decide to round up people who were out of status solely based on their religion or any other reason. So that was clearly a major crackdown. So it is a bad time in this country, without question, to be a Muslim. And of course, there's been many criminal cases that have been brought against Muslims, many of them just complete failures or setups by the government. So I think to be a Muslim now in this country is to be under suspicion. And in that sense, the First Amendment is really not protecting the free exercise of religion.
Now, what about freedom of the press? When all of the mainstream media, TV, cable, radio, etc., is owned by major corporations and some defense contractors, of course, we have freedom of the press on a smaller scale, certainly the internet, little local newspapers, volunteer programmers, say, such as myself. But what do you think of freedom of the press?
You know, we've said this for a while, that the concentration of our media in major corporations and wealthy corporations has made freedom of the press really illusory in many, many respects. What good does it do to me to stand, you know, in Central Park or to give an internet article? Sure, it reaches some people, but nothing like the major media reaches. And so our influence is very, very limited. When they wrote the First Amendment, obviously, freedom of the press was quite different. There was a much bigger marketplace of ideas. There wasn't the corporate concentration. There wasn't radio or TV, obviously. Newspaper towns had 10, 20 newspapers in them. So there was, you know, huge contending ideas and forces. People would go around the country speaking. Again, money didn't really control the media. Today, of course, that's very, very different. In addition, that's been aided and abetted. It's not just that money is controlling it. The money controlling it has been aided and abetted by the government, the courts included, which have allowed media concentration to continue. Whereas at one time, I don't remember the exact rules, you couldn't own more than one TV station in a large market. Now they've loosened all those rules. Media companies can not only own more than one TV station, they can own media across the board. So they can own a TV station and a newspaper and a radio station, as far as I know, within the same market area. So it's allowed huge, huge concentration of media. And of course, to keep that media going, you need advertising, and you need advertising from very wealthy corporations. And wealthy corporations are not about to do advertising that talk about, let's give some examples. A lot of people would like to have, you know, cars that give them 50 miles per gallon, but you're not going to get General Motors to advertise if the news media is saying, we need better cars with this global warming climate change, then General Motors is going to say, well, forget it, we're not advertising on your station. So it all sort of works together.
The Second Amendment to the Constitution reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, what was the intent of this? This wasn't so that people could run around hunting wildlife, was it? Wasn't this the right to resist tyranny? Was that the intent? What do you think?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, this was not about the individual right to bear arms. This was about militias, and at that time they didn't have a standing army, and the right to call up a militia to protect the republic or to put down an insurrection or if there was a problem. It wasn't about the individual right to have guns in your house for personal protection. At least that's what I think. Now, there's obviously a lot of debate around this among scholars, and so far the National Rifle Association has been winning that debate in Congress and otherwise, and not necessarily winning it because they're right, but winning it because they've been able to intimidate members of Congress about this issue. And it is a strong issue in this country, and they base it on, the frontier mentality and everything like that. So it's very hard to go against the National Rifle Association, but certainly the Second Amendment did not mean that individuals had a right as an individual matter to bear arms. Now, sadly, in this administration, for the first time that I can recall it happening, Ashcroft, when he was Attorney General, actually put into one of the government briefs that they now interpret the Second Amendment as the right of individuals to bear arms. So this is still a very contentious issue, but when you look at issues like the murder rate in the United States and the number of guns, you realize that we're basically uncivilized society in which, guns sadly rule a lot of people's lives. And I don't know how to say it more strongly than that. But this is really, I think it's the highest murder rate in the world or second in this country. And it's directly attributable to guns. And it's only, every couple of months we read about some slaughter in some school or high school or, supermarket or post office. And at bottom, of course, there's a lot of causes, but certainly one of them is the idea that guns are so freely available. And in fact, they won't even close loopholes. They claim that, you need to register to get a gun or have a background check. But then you find out that, well, yes, you need a background check, but at gun shows, which go on all over the country, you don't need it. You can just buy the gun from the guy at the gun show. So huge exception. So we're not close on this issue, in my view. And the Second Amendment has been, I think, completely stood on its head. I don't think anybody in their right mind would really say that it's meant that individuals can have guns.
I'm speaking with attorney and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner. Today's show, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Okay, the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. How are we doing with the Fourth Amendment?
Well, we could spend the whole hour on this one, because there isn't much left. And as I opened the show, I talked about warrantless wiretapping, and that's the question of whether, or electronic surveillance, whether the government can wiretap this conversation or any other conversation on the telephone, whether it can wiretap my calls abroad, whether it can look at my email. And that's a Fourth Amendment protected communication I'm having with you, the right to not have my words essentially searched and seized by the government, or my email. And that's just one part of it. And of course, what the president has done in this case, what Bush has done, is said despite a congressional law that requires a warrant, as does the Constitution, for all of this kind of surveillance, even if it's a warrant from a special court, which is the so-called secret court, the president went outside of that and said, I have the right to wiretap anybody I want in the name of national security. And obviously a violation of the Fourth Amendment, a fundamental violation, and it really just throws the Fourth Amendment out completely. Because if the president can say, I can do anything I want in the name of national security, including electronically surveil you, then we really have no Fourth Amendment left. So that's one of the major issues. The other one, of course, that comes to mind is the ability of, there's two others that are important. One is the ability of cops to stop you on the street, and what happens to that? When the Fourth Amendment protects the right of cops not to arrest you without probable cause. And we can look at that in two different aspects. One is domestically, what happens particularly in our communities of color or poor communities, where cops go in, they shake people down, they frisk them, they arrest them based on very flimsy evidence. Even the initial stop is done because they're people of color. We had that in New York City. That's how Amadou Diallo, was the guy who got 44 shots here, was murdered based on that kind of going into a people of color community and not obeying the dictates of the Fourth Amendment that you need probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion to stop somebody on the street. That happens massively across this country in communities of color. And then, of course, we have its international analog, which is what happens to people all over the world who are picked up, kidnapped by U.S. military, CIA, FBI, taken to places like Guantanamo, Bagram, and other places without any judicial scrutiny whatsoever. So you have it happening domestically, and you have it internationally. And that's the seizure of actual people. So pretty well gone, the Fourth Amendment. It's very hard for me to understand how we're going to really get our fundamental Fourth Amendment rights back.
And also with regard to the Fourth Amendment, having to do with searches and seizures, there's the entire Patriot Act legislation, which includes sneak and peek searches, access to records in international investigations, tracking internet usage, expanding the class of immigrants subject to removal, etc. Now, there's a huge area in that Patriot Act.
So that's correct. The Patriot Act gave the president a lot of powers under the Fourth Amendment, some of which may not be constitutional, and that includes going into your house without a warrant, that kind of power in certain circumstances. But what's most fascinating to me about the Patriot Act is that after 9/11, the president went to Congress and said, look, I need more power to do these kind of trackings, this kind of internet email, this kind of sneak and peek. And the president got that authority from Congress in the Patriot Act. And it's bad, broad authority. And then what happened is the president went way beyond that. The president said, and we didn't know it at the time, that, okay, I have that authority, but I'm going to actually not even bother with using that authority. I'm just going to assert national security right without going to the secret court to do electronic surveillance. Some of the issues that you're raising depended on going to the secret foreign intelligence surveillance court. Some didn't. But the president really dispensed with all of those. The Patriot Act does, though, has, of course, with regard to non-citizens, you know, is very, very nasty, not only in terms of the ability to hold them for a week or so without even going to court, but also the ability to get electronic surveillance of non-citizens in the United States. And also really the fact that it's not just the Patriot Act, but that they really have limited First Amendment rights. And we represent a lot of non-citizens. And, you know, it's hard to recommend a non-citizen, even a documented non-citizen, it's hard to recommend that they go to any kind of demonstrations or protests or asserting any kind of rights because this Bush administration is willing to go after people really based on their political views.
And then, of course, Amendment 5, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. It goes on to say, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. What is due process of law?
Well, due process of law is really the right to go into a court and, based on what is considered traditionally to be the process that people are entitled to under the law, to be able to go through that process. So, for example, if you have a criminal case against you, the process is, and the amendment lays it out, process, you have to be indicted by a grand jury. You have a right to an attorney, which is, of course, the Sixth Amendment. You have a right to make objection in court. You have a right to a jury that's of your peers. You can't just be summarily arrested, detained in prison, and not given a day in court, whether it's a civil matter or a criminal matter. A civil matter, you can't just have the government come to your house one day and say, oh, Michael, I don't think you should have a car, and take your car away. You have to have a right to go into court and actually have a fair process in court. And that's what due process is. And if you look at the Fifth Amendment, I mean, there's many, many gross ways in which you could just strike it out of the Constitution right now. Certainly for the people that we're representing at Guantanamo, these are people who are picked up anywhere in the world, taken to Guantanamo, never charged with a crime, and never having a day in court. Not just about habeas corpus, but never being charged with a crime. So they're not, the Fifth Amendment isn't being applied to them in any way whatsoever. The government would argue they're not U.S. citizens, are being held outside the country, they have no Fifth Amendment rights. But of course that has yet to be seen, and the idea that the Bush administration can pick up any non-citizen anywhere in the world and hold them outside of the Constitution and the Fifth Amendment is pretty nasty stuff. And obviously then, so that's the biggest, grossest, most open and notorious way the Fifth Amendment is now being violated. The right to due process, the right to a day in court is with people like those at Guantanamo. But obviously on another level in this country, you know, the Supreme Court has been particularly poor on protecting the rights of people, criminal defendants in particular, to get competent counsel, to have juries of their peers. So you have, like, lawyers who slept through part of their trials, the people still getting the death penalty. You had a recent case in the Supreme Court where a guy who was sentenced to a very long sentence was misadvised by the court on the number of days he had to appeal. The case goes to the Supreme Court, and they say, well, tough luck, even though it's not your fault. So you've had a lot of fundamental rights of people in this country to due process and to the Fifth Amendment stripped. And, of course, wealth plays a huge issue in that. People who have money obviously get much better lawyers and do much better in court than poor people who often don't have good lawyers and get convicted very, very, very readily.
I'm speaking with attorney and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner. Today's show, the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Okay, let's take a look at the Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, etc. How are we doing with regard to speedy trials?
Well, we have people who languish a very long time, and of course, again, in the post 9/11 period, we don't give trials at all to hundreds of people who we are now holding in what you would have to call preventive detention, although I'm not sure what it's preventing, all over the world, and we're not giving speedy trials at all, and we're generally not giving them attorneys at all. And I think that's just, you know, it's appalling. Everybody thinks it's appalling, and of course, as I mentioned, even in the Fifth Amendment due process context, even in this country, with criminal defendants, a lot of them are not getting competent counsel. You know, a lot are obviously places there's places that are more enlightened on that issue and have very good legal aid systems for poor criminal defendants. But there's a lot of places, Texas, Bush's state being one of the major ones, where even death penalty defendants oftentimes have lawyers who are really ill-prepared and in many cases have actually rarely, if ever, tried such serious death penalty cases. And so they're not getting competent counsel.
And of course, the Sixth Amendment goes on to say, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Now, these Guantanamo people haven't even been charged with anything.
None of the above, right. They don't know the charges against them. They don't get confronted with the witnesses. There's a little sort of mock military thing. But when they ask to cross-examine the witness, to see the witness, they can't. They put in an affidavit, so you don't know anything about the witness. They often don't get to see the information because it's supposedly classified. So they get essentially kept in prison through a Kafkaesque system in which they can't confront the witnesses, they can't cross-examine the witnesses, and oftentimes they don't even know what the evidence is against them. And then the decision is made, you know, in secret, essentially. And then they're told, you're simply going to have to stay in Guantanamo. And you're also allowed to use evidence from coercion and torture in those cases. So clearly, in the Guantanamo cases, none of the Sixth Amendment rights are there. And you don't have an attorney in those cases.
And then, of course, the Seventh Amendment has to do with the right of trial by jury. This right shall be preserved. Well, these guys aren't getting jury trials, are they?
No, none of these... None of the Guantanamo people have jury trials. I mean, the government's argument here is that, you know, the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Seventh Amendments simply don't apply to people like those at Guantanamo. Why, I am not sure. I mean, they claim is they're picked up outside the country, they're kept in places outside the country. But the question you have to ask yourself, is your right to a trial, is your right to charges, is your right to an attorney, is your right to a jury dependent on the fact that the government decides to keep you outside rather than bring you into the country? Certainly seems that it should not to me, and it certainly seems that way to a number of judges who've tried to write on this, but so far we haven't won on those issues. But the sad part is, if we don't win on those issues, we're looking at a model for the future in which something will have fundamentally changed in the country. The idea that you could give the executive the power to pick up people anywhere in the world and hold them forever is something that, you know, really is unheard of in my view.
And also, where in the Constitution does it say that cruel and unusual punishment is against the Constitution? Is that in one of the amendments?
That's the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. It says that it prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. The Supreme Court has limited that in many ways, one of them being to, you know, sentencing situations. And the question is whether it applies to people like those at Guantanamo. First, there's the issue of does it apply at Guantanamo? But secondly, there's the issue of does it apply if the person hasn't been sentenced yet? It would seem to be a very technical reading to say it doesn't. But you know, that cruel and unusual punishment, that prohibition is reflected in treaties the United States has signed, the Convention Against Torture, statutes that have been passed pursuant to that treaty, the Geneva Conventions and its prohibition on torture and inhumane treatment. Those are all part of our Constitution because part of the Constitution itself says treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. And so that those treaties we've signed, which contain similar prohibitions to cruel and unusual punishment of the Eighth Amendment, are again part of our Constitution. And torture, inhumane treatment, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, just flatly prohibited.
Michael Ratner, thank you very much.
Thank you for doing this. It's a great idea to do.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You've been listening to attorney Michael Ratner. Today's show has been the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael Ratner has been adjunct professor of international human rights litigation at the Columbia Law School, lecturer at Yale Law School, and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Thanks to Todd Fletcher and Mickey Huff for research assistance. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yaro Mako. Visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? For all you sleeping souls, wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?